Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on our awesome universe when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea isn't full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year the continents and islands of this earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's been calculated at about 286,000 cubic miles of water pour into the oceans every year. Well, now for century after century and millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea hasn't been increased by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle or circle of evaporation and precipitation. The writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Now, every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds again, and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide and begin their journey all over again. Well, now, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood, and its laws are fairly well comprehended. Modern science has now learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And it's one more of the many lessons that we conduct here in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. And it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Our awesome universe. The universe. It's a pretty big place. In fact, when I was a kid, they used to tell us that the universe was composed of the Milky Way galaxy. It's about all we could see with the Mount Wilson telescope. They figured there was something more out there, but all they could really see is a lot of gas. They really couldn't see with clarity, like we can today, the size of the universe, which extends out about 12 billion light years. Well, that's quite a range. And so, when I was a kid, I went to school and they told us about billions and billions of years ago. And I believed it because I didn't have any reason not to. So it made me wonder, what was the greatest hoax ever perpetrated upon the human race? Was it the Federal Reserve? Was it religion? Any particular religion, or paper money maybe? Or global warming? That's the big new hot item today. Evolution, 9/11, Pearl Harbor, Remember the Maine, or was it Columbus discovered America first? Or maybe it's Christmas, Easter, or New Year's. All of these are hoaxes. All of these are lies. We're all familiar with them. You've heard the battle cry, remember the Maine. And the reason that we went to war with Spain was because those dirty Spaniards came over there, snuck up under our battleship in Havana Harbor and blew it up. And we weren't going to take that laying down. So, you know, we went over there and taught those guys a thing or two. Kind of reminds you of Iraq, doesn't it? Knock down our buildings, will you? We'll go over there and teach you guys a thing or two. Now we find out that these are hoaxes later on. At the time, it sounded like it was a pretty logical thing, and we probably ought to believe it. But as time progresses along, we find out the truth about these things. The sinking of the Lusitania, Pearl Harbor. We find out that Roosevelt knew about an attack coming on American forces at Pearl Harbor before it ever happened. With specificity, we'd already broken the Japanese code. So President Roosevelt knew it, and he didn't say anything about it so that the Japanese would go ahead and attack, and then he could come before Congress and said, this is a day that's going to live in infamy. I mean, we have to do something to get you people riled up so that we can get you to go to war. That's what we want you to do. That's where we're headed. That's where our policies are directed. And so we have these hoaxes that go on. And I can't think of a greater hoax than evolutionary philosophy. And it breaks down into a number of gambits. So I thought I'd start here with the universe, because this is where the Big Bang starts. This is where evolution starts. It starts with what they call the Big Bang Theory. Now that's where something very, very tiny blew up a long, long time ago and created everything that's out here in the universe that we can see, that we can know about. And there it is. And it happened a long time ago. Now, I'm a law school teacher, and here in law, here, at least here in the United States, the judicial process is aimed at uncovering the truth. And the truth is oftentimes very, very unpopular. I mean, I can't think of a case that I've ever done that there wasn't some truth that came out in the case that I just assumed didn't see the light of day. You know, you take a divorce case, for instance, and what we're really interested in here is the divorce and the property settlement and a custody settlement and so on. But you'll find that when you get into a divorce case, there's all kinds of dirty linen that gets aired. Dirty linen that one side or the other would just as soon stays buried forever. We really don't want to talk about that. But it's not to be, because when you get into the courtroom, there's a truth-seeking process that goes on here. And so the judge, the prosecutor, or both lawyers that are working the case, the real intent of the adjudicatory process is to bring forth the truth no matter who it hurts. So if you don't want the truth to be known and you want to stay the hell out of court, let me tell you, that's the last place you want to go, because you're going to find out all kinds of things that you just as soon stayed buried forever and were locked up in the closet and nobody knew about. So lawyers and judges are truth seekers, and oftentimes we're shocked by what comes out. I mean, I can't speak for every judge or every lawyer out there, but let me tell you that oftentimes when I'm in court and I see something come up, I am absolutely blown away, just shocked. I look at that and I go, oh my God, I didn't know that. And sometimes it's something that I've brought out on cross-examination, or maybe it's something that I inadvertently brought out on direct examination and I didn't really intend to, but, you know, there it is. And sometimes it helps me, sometimes it hurts me, and I try to guide it so that it helps me more than hurts me. But my point is this: the adjudicatory process and lawyers and the judicial process is there for the purposes of bringing out the truth. Now, there are people, not many, but there are people in the world that are interested in the truth. Now, most people would just assume that we stay away from that. Truth is not something that's universally accepted or desired. We're not really looking for the truth of 9/11. In fact, the perpetrators of 9/11 would just assume that what happened there be forgotten about. We've already made our point. We've already written the history. It's already been entered into the books, and we don't want the truth to come out. It will at some point in time. It always does. But after 50 years, it doesn't impress people. If we knew the truth about 9/11 early on, it would enrage us. But as the passage of time accumulates, then it isn't nearly as shocking. Like the Lusitania, which was carrying armaments for the English from America, which professed itself to be a neutral country. The Germans found out about it and said, if we catch that ship on the high sea, we're going to sink it. Published the information in 5 newspapers. My granddad told me that Lusitania story before he died, and he told me how bad and wicked and evil and awful the Germans were. Well, he died in 1951. In 1967, 50 years after the American involvement started in World War I, the truth came out. Yes, it was carrying armaments, and it was special caliber armaments that were manufactured in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and then shipped to New York and loaded on the ship and sent over to England. We'd been doing that for years. Same thing was true in World War II. So America was not neutral. We lied. And Americans don't like their government being discovered to be liars. We don't care much for that. And we just assume that was hidden and buried forever. But the truth comes out. And when the truth comes out, some people will pick up on that and they'll learn from it. Most people don't. Old Winston Churchill made an observation one time. I always liked old Winnie. He had some pretty wise old sayings, and he said that in his observations, he said, most men at some point in their lives will stumble upon the truth. But he said, most of them will pick themselves up, brush themselves off, and hurry about their business as if not much of any consequence had occurred to them. Now, that's the way the average guy takes the truth. So you know about Christmas. I'm not telling you something new. You know that this big fat man that you saw down at Battlefield Mall does not come down a 6-inch chimney. And yet, you put stockings out there and tell your little children that this guy, Santa Claus, is going to come down the chimney and he's going to leave presents. He's not. It's you and your wife that are going to be leaving the presents there. But you lie to your children and you tell them about Christmas. Now, you know it's a lie, and you know that someday they're going to find out about that lie. And you know your children are going to grow up and they're going to perpetuate that lie upon their children and upon their children. And it seems to be a good thing to do. Lying just seems to be the right thing to do. Now, I don't know why it is then that people get so upset when they're lied to. Because we lie to our children about rabbits at Easter laying eggs, and we lie to them about Christmas, we lie to them about religion, we lie to them about just about, any and everything that we can think of. We lie to them about the battleship Maine, we lie to them about what they're learning in public schools. And the tragic part of it is that not only are we lying to them, we know we're lying to them. My parents knew that they were lying to me. Now, I took a look at that years back, and I didn't lie to my children. I told them Christmas was a fabrication. It's a religious ideology that's not in the Bible. It's a fabrication. I don't know that it did me any good, but at least I thought it did at the time, and so I told them the truth. And so I got into a business, in the legal business over here, which deals a lot with the truth. We deal with lies. We deal with liars. And we expose liars. There's 23 ways to expose a liar on cross-examination. I know all 23 of them. I practice them. Every time I go in and get somebody on the witness stand, I do my very level best to expose his lies. And oftentimes I'm successful and I embarrass people and shock the audience. And I don't know. I get a big kick out of that for some reason. And so I guess that's why I do what I do, because I like to uncover the truth. It's just something about digging in to a story, digging in to some facts, digging in to what people you know, accept and believe, and then destroying their faith in their beliefs, exposing their lies for everybody to see. There's just got to be something perverse about that, doesn't there? So when I talk about the universe over here, I'm citing from a book. I'm going to review a book here. It's called Life: How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or by Creation. It's put out by the Jehovah's Witnesses. So before you think that, oh my God, this guy Gordon's jumped off into Jehovah's Witness theology over here, I haven't. I don't subscribe to Jehovah's Witness theology. But you know, every once in a while, hell, even the Pope comes up with something good, you know? There's a little truth everywhere that you look. You know, you'll find a little truth in Catholicism, you'll find a little truth over here in Jehovah's Witnessism, and every once in a while you'll... Now this book doesn't have 100% truth. There's three or four things in here that I saw that were scientifically incorrect, but by and large, it was a heck of a good book. And I'll tell you another thing that really caught my eyeball. 18 million copies of this book have been sold. Or given away. I don't know if they sell them or give them away, but it was published back in 1985 by the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society of Pennsylvania. This book is published in 19 languages. Total books printed of all editions, 18,800,000 copies. And that was back in 1985. If this book is still in print, and if they're still printing this book, God only knows how many copies are out there. So 18 million people have a copy of this book. And if it's like our family here, you know, when we buy a book, there's four members of our family, and like as not, all four members will read it, you know. So if four people read that book, I mean, we're talking 80 million people in 19 different languages have read this book. And it's an expose on science and the Bible. And I've said from time to time, the Bible is a science book. I know religious people say, well, the Bible isn't a science book. Those are people that are apologizing for the science in the Bible. See, they apologize for it. God bless them Christians out there. They're just apologizing for God every day of the week because of his mistakes. You know, they believe that the Bible is full of scientific errors. And so they say, well, you know, the Bible isn't a science book. The Bible has science from cover to cover. I mean, it's got scientific statements, and it's got statements in it that are historical, that are predicated upon science and scientific inquiry. In my opening ad here, I said, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1:7 that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. That is a scientific statement. It is absolutely true. It is absolutely correct. It is absolutely verifiable. That is science in the Bible, written 3,000 years ago. And get this, nobody knew that in 1900. That's fact. In 1900, we still did not understand the meteorological cycles that we do today. And that was only 100 years ago. Go back 200, 300, 500, 1,000. Years ago, you know, those people were walking around, figuratively speaking, you know, with their knuckles dragging on the ground. That's what they knew about meteorology. Now, we're getting smarter and smarter. In fact, I've reported to you here recently that our Air Force is in the process of controlling the weather. They're going to take over the weather systems of the world. And they're going to make it rain on some places and cause floods, and they're going to withhold the rain on other places, and they're going to have droughts. They're going to have the technology to bring any nation in the world to its knees. Now, that's the United States Air Force. I don't know what the Russians are planning, or the Chinese, or the Brazilians, or British. I don't know. They might have their own ideas about that, but that's what the United States Air Force is working on, and that's what our Congress has authorized and paid for. Now, I'd say that's quite a little story. Now, in this book, Chapter 9, Our Awesome Universe, they start out like this. It says, for thousands of years, people have marveled at the starry heavens. On a clear night, the beautiful stars hang like shining jewels against the darkness of space. A moonlit night bathes the earth with a beauty all its own. And those who think about what they see often wonder just what's out there in space. How is it organized? Can we find out how it all got started? Well, answers to these questions would no doubt help determine more accurately why the Earth, with its human and other life, came to be and what the future may hold. Now, many centuries ago, it was thought that the universe was made up of the few thousand stars that could be seen with the naked eye. But now, with powerful instruments that scan the heavens, scientists know that there is much, much more out there. In fact, what has been observed is far more awesome than anyone had ever imagined. The human mind is staggered by the immensity and the complexity of it all. And as National Geographic magazine commented, what man is now learning about the universe has left him stunned. So it has an awesome size to it. In recent centuries, astronomers who scanned the heavens with early telescopes noticed some fuzzy, cloud-like formations. And they assumed that these were nearby clouds of gases, but in the 1920s, as larger, more powerful telescopes came into use, these gases were found to be something far more immense and significant. Today, we call them galaxies. Now, a galaxy is a vast group of stars. It's composed of gas and other material rotating around a central nucleus. These galaxies have been called island universes, for each one of them is in itself like a universe. For example, consider the galaxy that we live in, and we call it the Milky Way. Our solar system, that is, our sun and the Earth and the other planets with their moons, is a part of this galaxy. But it's only a very tiny part, because our Milky Way galaxy contains over 100 billion stars. 100 billion. And some scientists estimate that there are at least 200 to 400 billion stars. And one science editor even went so far as to say there could be as many as 5 to 10 trillion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. I'm going to pause there and make a little editorial comment. Because when I was a kid, you know, just going back here to the 1940s, we could hardly see outside the Milky Way galaxy. I mean, this is where we're at in the Milky Way. And I got a picture here of it. And we're out here on the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. So when we're looking, in this case, north, we couldn't see through the galaxy. All we would see is fuzz. But if we look south, if we look the other way, we can look out into space, away from our galaxy. So we can see our galaxy, and we're a part of it. And when I was a kid, we thought that was the universe. You know, I'm still living, you know, and so in my lifetime, we thought, hey, you know, this is it. Now, we've got this Hubble telescope, and when I was a kid, they could look out into space 2.5 billion light years. And it wasn't too far before that. You know, it was just a few years. It was in the 1930s that they put that Mount Wilson telescope up there so that they could see out there 2.5 billion light years. Prior to that, they didn't have a clue. Now, after Mount Wilson, you know, in more modern times with the Hubble telescope, they've gone a step further. They can now look out into space 12.5 billion light years, you know, about five times further, five or six. And so what do they see in the distance between 2.5 and 12.5 billion light years? And the answer is, well, they see more of the same. And they're in the process now of preparing a new Hubble 2, I believe it is. They call it the Hubble 2. And they've got a bigger telescope, and they got more sophisticated electronics and so on. So they expect to be able to look out there 25 billion light years. Now, that's a fur piece, as they say down here in the Ozarks. A light year is the distance that it takes light to travel at the speed of light. That's 186,000 miles a second. So if you were traveling at the speed of light, you'd be traveling 186,000 miles a second. I mean, every second. Multiply that times 60, and that would tell you how far you traveled in a minute. And then you multiply that times 24, and that'll tell you how far you're going to travel in a day, and then times 7, and that's how far you could travel in a week, and then times 30, that'll tell you how far you can go in a month, and times 365 days, that'll tell you how far you're going to go in a year. Well, it's about 6 trillion miles a year. The diameter of our galaxy spans so vast a distance that if you could travel as fast as the speed of light, 186,282 miles a second, it'd take you 100,000 years to cross the Milky Way galaxy. 100,000 years. If you could travel at the speed of light. Now, of course, we travel about 25,000 miles an hour, you know, in our spacecraft going up here to the space station. And you hear Carl Sagan, you remember that old guy, you know, he used to be on TV, Carl Sagan? He had a lisp, you know, he couldn't speak too well. So he said, billions and billions of years ago, he would say. He couldn't say billions, he had billions. Well, anyway, he had quite a little story to tell. I know it's like old Carl. He was a fun guy to watch, you know, but he was about as full of baloney as a Christmas goose. I mean, that guy'd lie when the truth would serve his purpose better. And the reason I say that is because he knew better. See, it's one thing to be a plumber and you believe something and you don't know any different. It's something else when you're an astronomer and you know what you're telling people is a damn lie. Of course, I'm not saying that plumbers don't lie a lot. You know, if I came out, you know, to fix your pipes, I'd say, oh my God, you won't believe how bad your pipes are. You're going to have to replumb your whole house. I mean, you got a leak over there and the next thing you got a $5,000 replumbing job coming up. So I'm not sitting here, you know, saying that plumbers don't lie, and that carpenters don't lie, and general contractors don't lie. I'm just pointing out that Sagan was a liar, and he knew he was lying. And a lot of guys, you know, that are lying about this evolution crap over here, they know they're lying to you. And, of course, you and I know, being plumbers and carpenters and blue-collar workers, we don't know any different, and so we believe their lies. Kind of like that war in Iraq, you know, they told us, hey, you know, this guy Saddam Hussein over here, he's got weapons of mass destruction. We need to go to war. And that sounded like a pretty good idea 3 or 4 years ago. But, you know, then we found out after we got into it that they didn't have any weapons of mass destruction. And so then the president said, oh, my God, we didn't know that. He's a liar. He knew that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. He gets briefed every day by the CIA. But he wanted to go to war against Iraq, and we had to have a reason. Just like President Roosevelt had to have a reason to go to war. He knew that they were going to attack Pearl Harbor. He could have thwarted that attack if he'd have put his mind to it. But you see, by getting caught flat-footed and 3,000 Americans get killed in one morning, you know, it just ticked everybody off, and people lined up to join the army to go to war. That's what they wanted. They wanted war. They wanted America to get into World War II. Now, that's the truth of the matter. Now, I'm not here to say that World War II wasn't a good idea, that we shouldn't have got involved in the war. Maybe it was a hell of a good idea. I'm not here to criticize President Bush and the war in Iraq. That war in Iraq has got a purpose. It's a twofold purpose. Number one, we need the Iraqi oil, and we want to take it for Exxon and Standard Oil. And it just seems like going over there and going to war and taking it by force of arms is the logical thing to do. They've got 25% of the Earth's oil resources right there in Iraq. 25% of all the known oil in the world, provable oil reserves, is sitting right there, and we're going to go take it. And then secondly, we had a recession in 2000, and in order to pull us out of the recession, we have to spend money. Now, normally what we do is we spend money with deficit financing. The federal government runs up a budget deficit, and that budget deficit is the stimulus to the economy. Well, when the economy goes into recession, it needs a bigger stimulus. And so to get a bigger stimulus, you need a way to spend money faster. And the best way to do that is through war. And so it keeps everybody's mind off the economy and on the war. And then there's an outcome, and that outcome is we're going to take all their oil. Now, that's the real purpose behind it. Now, in order to get you behind the program over here, we had to lie to you, you know, just a little bit. So we lied to you, and we said, well, we're going to establish democracy, and we're going to depose this bad, awful dictator, and we're going to do all these wonderful things. Well, the thing didn't work out quite the way we figured. Moral to the story is that oftentimes we get lied to. Hey, I'm at the halfway point here, and I got to remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, they're accurate, and they're correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the book we're reviewing is called Life, How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or Creation. It's put out by the Jehovah's Witnesses. You may not want to call the Jehovah's Witnesses and have them deliver a copy to your home. They typically want to convert you when they get there. They've got a program. And I'm not for or against them one way or the other. I would suggest you go down to your used bookstore and just tell them that you're looking for a Watchtower Bible and Tract Society publication called, and then there's the name of it again, Life, How Did It Get Here? By Evolution or by Creation. Fairly straightforward question. 20 chapters in the book, a couple hundred pages, maybe a little more, maybe 300 pages. Let's see. 255 pages. Well done. Really well done. I read a lot of science and educational type material, and it was really well done, really well worth the money. And it's in simple language. It can be read by an adult. I enjoyed reading it. I read the book. I enjoyed it. And I've probably read 20 books like it or similar to it, and I enjoyed it. And you could give this to, I think, to just about a, you know, maybe a fourth, fifth, sixth grader, something like that. I think they could just pull that right together. There's a couple of unscientific things in here, like the gap theory, for instance, which is unscriptural. But then, you know, there again, it's their opinion, and they're certainly entitled to it. And you ought to be able to read through that. Well, anyway, going back here to the book, we're talking about the size here of the universe. And they're bringing this to your attention over here. This thing is really big. And we're just talking about one galaxy here, which is 100,000 years at the speed of light to go from one side of the Milky Way to the other. Now, that's a fur piece. Now, it's almost impossible for the human mind to comprehend that kind of size and distance, and yet our galaxy is just the beginning of what is in outer space. And there's something even more staggering, and it's this. There are so many galaxies have now been detected that it has been said that they're as common as blades of grass on the lawn. There's about 10 billion galaxies. That's about 10 billion galaxies are in the observable universe. They're just looking out there. But there are many more beyond the range of today's telescopes. And some astronomers estimate that there are 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and each galaxy can contain hundreds of billions of stars. Kent Hovind, the other day, I was watching one of his videos, and he said he thought, based upon the Hubble telescope, that there was around 2 trillion galaxies. Okay. Now, let me hit you with this one again. See, we got this solar system, and we little earthlings are down here, and we're traveling out to the moon, and they've got a project now. I just saw one that was cut loose the other day, a rocket, and they fired up. And it's going to reach out, I don't know, it's going to be in 2012 or 13. I mean, 4 or 5 years from now, it's going to reach out, and it's going to get to, I think it's Neptune or someplace. See, there's 9 planets in our solar system. There's 9 worlds like our Earth, like Mars and Venus and Saturn and so on. There's 9 of those. Well, we can travel out here with our technology today. You know, in 5 or 10 years, we can get out here maybe to Pluto. We can, you know, in 5 years, we can get to Mars or something like that. And they're just out there, you know, right up next door. That's our neighbor. 235,000 miles to the moon, and that takes about a week trip, 3 days out and 3 days back. And that's just to the moon, you know. Now, you know, we're talking about a galaxy here that takes 100,000 years at the speed of light to get across. And we got 2 trillion of those. Now, I just got to thinking about that the other day, and I said, you know, when God made all that, he must have had a reason for doing that. I mean, he didn't need to make that thing quite that big. You know, he could have made it half that size. Would have served his purpose probably just about as good, far as I'm concerned, because there isn't anybody here on planet Earth that's going out here, you know, 100,000 light years to cross the Milky Way at the speed of light. That's assuming that we could do that. And that's because, you know, we only live for 70 years. So when I listen to Carl Sagan and all these jerks over here from NASA and so on talk about, well, we're going out and colonize the universe. There's an old adage where I come from, you know, you're going to do it and fall back in it. That's all you're going to do. And then it's even stupid to even be talking about going out here. The closest star we got to is 7,000 light years away. It's called Alpha Centauri. Alpha Centauri. 7,000 light years away. And you're going to go out to Alpha Centauri, are you? Anytime soon? You're going to do that next week, are you? I mean, boys and girls, if you could travel at the speed of light, which is theoretical, isn't even intelligent, and it's going to take you 7,000 years to get out there, so it's pretty obvious that this creator, this God, whatever, you know, whoever this guy is that built this, he must have a better way of traveling around out in the universe than the speed of light, which is the fastest thing that we know of. In our, you know, our realm of physics. Carl Sagan, you know, he was always talking about going out and colonizing the universe, going out and exploring the universe. What a dunderhead. I mean, that guy didn't have a brain in his head. He probably had a PhD. Now, there's clusters of these galaxies, and yet there's more to this. You know, these awesome galaxies are not scattered haphazardly out in space. Instead, they are usually arranged in definite groups called clusters. They are arranged in clusters like grapes in a bunch. Thousands of these galactic clusters already have been observed and photographed. Some clusters contain relatively few galaxies. Our Milky Way galaxy, for example, is part of a cluster of about 20 galaxies. Within this local group, there is one neighbor galaxy that can be seen without a telescope on a clear night. It's called the Andromeda Galaxy, which has a spiral shape similar to ours. Other galactic clusters are made up of many dozens, perhaps hundreds, or even thousands of galaxies. And one such cluster is thought to contain about 10,000 galaxies like our Milky Way. Now, the distance between galaxies within a cluster may average about 1 million light years. Now, remember, the distance across our galaxy here is 100,000 light years. Multiply that times 10, and that's how much space there is between these grapes in the cluster called galaxies. About 1 million light years. However, the distance from one galactic cluster to another may be 100 times that. So it may be 100 million light years from one galaxy to the next. And there's even evidence that the clusters themselves are arranged in superclusters, like bunches of grapes on a vine. What colossal size and brilliant organization. Now, coming down to our local solar system, we find another superbly organized arrangement. The Sun, which is a medium-sized star, is the nucleus around which the Earth and the other planets with their moons move in precise orbits. Year after year, they revolve with such mathematical certainty that astronomers can accurately predict where they will be at any future time. Looking into infinitesimal things, atoms, for instance, we see that the same precision exists. An atom is a marvel of order resembling the order of our solar system. It includes a nucleus containing particles called protons and neutrons, surrounded by tiny orbiting electrons. All matter is made up of these building blocks. What makes one substance differ from the other is the number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus and the number, and the arrangement of the electrons revolving around it. Now, this has an exquisite order. Since all the elements that make up matter can be arranged in exact sequence by the number of those building blocks present. Now, what's behind all of this organization? Now, as we have noted, the size of the universe is truly awesome. So, is its marvelous arrangement. From the infinitely large to the infinitesimally small, from galactic clusters to atoms, the universe is characterized by superb organization. Discover magazine said, quote, "We perceived the order in surprise, and our cosmologists and physicists continue to find new and astonishing aspects of this superb order." We used to say it was a miracle, and we still permit ourselves to refer to the whole universe as a marvel. This orderly structure is acknowledged even in the word commonly used in astronomy to describe the universe. We call it the cosmos, and it is defined in one dictionary as an orderly, harmonious, systematic universe. Now, former astronaut John Glenn noted the orderliness of the whole universe about us, and that the galaxies were all traveling in prescribed orbits in relation to one another. He therefore asked, could this have just happened by accident? Was it an accident that a bunch of flotsam and jetsam suddenly started making these orbits of its own accord? And he concluded, I can't believe that. Some power put all of this into orbit and keeps it there. Indeed, the universe is so precisely organized that man can use the heavenly bodies as the basis for his timekeeping. But any well-designed timepiece obviously is the product of an orderly mind that has the ability to design, and an orderly mind that designs can be possessed only by an intelligent person. Then what about the far more complex design and dependability that exists throughout the universe? Would this not also betoken a designer? A maker, a mind, an intelligence? And do you have any reason to believe that intelligence can exist apart from personality? Now, we cannot get around it. Superb organization requires a superb organizer. Nothing in our experience indicates that anything organized happens by chance or by accident. Rather, our entire experience in life shows that everything organized must have an organizer. Every machine, every computer, every building, yes, even pencil and paper, had a maker, an organizer. Logically, the far more complex and awesome organization in the universe must have had an organizer also. Now, law requires a lawmaker, and also the entire universe from atoms to galaxies is governed by definite physical laws. There are laws for governing heat, light, sound, and gravity, for example. As scientist and physicist Stephen W. Hawking said, "The more we examine the universe, we find it is not arbitrary at all, but it obeys certain well-defined laws and that it operates in different areas. It seems very reasonable to suppose that there may be some underlying principles so that all laws are part of some bigger law." Rocket expert Wernher von Braun went a step further when he said, "The natural laws of the universe are so precise that we have no difficulty building a spaceship to fly to the moon and can time the flight with the precision of a fraction of a second. These laws must have been set by somebody. Scientists who want a rocket to orbit the Earth or the moon must work in harmony with such universal laws if they are to be successful. When we think of laws, we acknowledge that they came from a lawmaking entity. A traffic sign that says stop certainly has behind it some person or group of persons who originated the law and had a purpose for it. What then about the comprehensive laws that govern the material universe? Such brilliantly conceived laws surely bear witness to a supremely intelligent lawmaker." After commenting on all of the special conditions of order and law that are so apparent in the universe, Science News observed, quote, "Contemplation of these things disturbs cosmologists because it seems as if such particular and precise conditions could hardly have arisen at random. One way to deal with the question is to say the whole thing was contrived and then lay it on divine providence." Unquote. Now, many persons, including many scientists, are not willing to concede or to conclude that much. But others are willing to acknowledge that the evidence keeps insisting that there's intelligence behind it all. They acknowledge that such colossal size, such harmonious precision, and the law as exists throughout the universe could never have just happened by accident. All these things must be the products of a superior mind. This is the conclusion expressed by one Bible writer who said regarding the physical heavens, "Raise your eyes high up and see who has created these things. It is the one who is bringing forth the army of them even by number. All of them he calls even by name. That one is identified as the creator of the heavens, and the grand one stretches them out." That's recorded in Isaiah 40, verse 26, and Isaiah 42, verse 5. Let me pause here for a moment. Did you hear that statement here? "It is the one who is bringing forth the army of them, even by number, all of whom he calls by name." He's got every star out there numbered. He went a step further and said, "I got a name for every one of them." Now, you know, I'm a pretty intelligent guy. I mean, I'm, you know, fair to middling. You know, I score around 80 on the intelligence test. About like a orangutan, I'd guess. And I can't number 1 billion. I have never counted to a billion. That's 1,000 million. I have never counted from 1 to 1 million. I haven't even counted to 100,000. And I'm literate. I can count. I can do my numbers. And this guy comes along and says, not only have I got numbers for them all, I've got a name for every one of them. Boys and girls, we can't even tell you how many galaxies are out there. And this guy comes along and says, I have numbered every star and every planet in every galaxy. I can tell you how many galaxies there are. I've got them all, I got them all named. I can tell you how many stars are in the Milky Way galaxy because I got them all numbered and I've got all of those named. And then I can tell you how many planets are out there and how many moons are in there. I've got all of those named as well. I mean, this guy just kind of likes to rub it into you, doesn't he? Now, I don't know how big this guy is. Oral Roberts, one time, he said that he saw a 600-foot Jesus. If I saw a 600-foot Jesus, I'd still be running. And this guy is something else, ain't he? And he hasn't even taken the time to tell you how big this universe is. I mean, you know, he tells you to look up and see what you see. But he hasn't said, hey, listen, when you get through with the Hubble telescope and you can look out here from 2 to 12 billion light years and then you upgrade your Hubble until you can look out 25 billion light years and you think you're going to look in my bedroom window, I got news for you, sucker, because there's another 50 or 100 billion light years more out there. How far out there does this thing go? Now, the guy that made this, he said he made it in one day. I mean, you go back here to Genesis chapter 1. I mean, you know, not only is this thing big, but he says, I made this thing all in one day. Did you get that? I mean, these evolutionists say, well, over billions and billions of years, an explosion caused all of this. That's a damn lie. And these guys all know that that's a lie because of entropy. There's been no past eternity of matter. Matter is running down. And because matter is running down, we call it the laws of thermodynamics. No discovery of true science takes God by surprise. And we should expect that. In his wisdom, there would be hints of these truths found in his word, the Bible. The first law speaks of a total creation, originally completed and now sustained by God's power. And the second law speaks of the curse of decay and death brought on by man's sin and causing an overall degeneration in everything. And we call this the first law of energy is conserved. And all existing processes of nature merely change energy from one form to another. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. Matter itself, which is potential atomic energy, is maintained at a constant level. Processes change matter and energy from one form to others, but the total quantity of energy in the universe always remains the same. It's not being created. It's not being dissipated. It's changing forms, but it's not coming into existence today, and it's not going out of existence. And these guys, they come along and they say, well, you know, we had this mass and matter over here and it blew up. Second law of energy dissipates. As processes in nature occur, the total energy reservoir is reduced to simpler forms with a consequent increase in what has been termed entropy. As energy is used, it becomes less available for further use. Part of the energy spent to produce something is always lost by radiation, friction, or other effects. It becomes non-recoverable heat dissipating in space. Ultimately, as things are going, the entire universe will end up being filled with a stagnant mass of low-level heat energy. Now, boys and girls, Carl Sagan knew that. And when he said that all this mass and matter organized itself into one clump and blew up, He lied to us. Because what we're observing is the mass and matter is degenerating into low-level energy. And that's what it would have started from, low-level energy. Now, whoever wound this clock up, whoever put this thing into operation, can create mass and matter out of nothing. Because that's where it came from. Mass and matter came out of nothing. But we do not observe it coming into existence today, nor do we observe it going out of existence today. And we can't do that. Somebody can, but it isn't you and me. And the people who are in science, the people who are in physics, the people that wear those white coats and who are walking around writing textbooks, lying to us, no better. And right there is the law of energy conserved and energy dissipated. It's called the two laws of thermodynamics. Now, I think that, you know, even us dumb plumbers over here can understand that. Now, you know, you may believe in Allah, or you may believe in evolution, or you may believe in this or that or something else. I'm not here to convince you that I'm right and you're wrong. I'm just here to tell you that we've been lied to. And furthermore, these suckers that are lying to us and writing these textbooks over here, you know they're lying to us. And they know that they're smarter than we are and that we're going to believe their lies, just like your five-year-old or your four-year-old. He believes that Santa Claus is coming down that six-inch pipe and going to leave him all them toys. His mind can't quite wrap itself around the size of Santa Claus down at Battle Creek Mall, or Battlefield Mall, and the size of the stovepipe or the chimney that he's going to be coming down. But he will. One of these days, it'll dawn on him that you're lying to him. Most men do not come to a conscious realization that they're liars and that they've been lied to. They perpetrate those lies. I don't doubt but what President Johnson actually believed the crap that he was telling us, more than likely. George Bush may actually believe his own propaganda. He may actually believe his own press releases. But boys and girls, if I said to you that a stealth bomber last week dropped a guided bomb onto a house and it exploded, and the explosion caused the house to disintegrate into smaller components, which blew up into the air and fell back down to the earth. And that those components, after the explosion, when they fell back down to the earth, they created another house with a red tile roof with 18 windows and 3 access doors. Fully plumbed, fully wired, with light bulbs in the sockets, with carpet on the floor and drapes at the windows, with a lawn that was planted in green, with all of the landscaping in and 3 trees in the front yard, and it all happened from an explosion and random chance. What would you think of that? Anybody that would believe a cock and bull story like that would have to be a lunatic. You'd have to be spaced out on LSD and crank and maybe 3 shots of heroin to boot to believe that kind of a story. And yet we're told that kind of crap every day in our public schools. We went to college and got degrees after our names, didn't we, to believe that? Hey, I'm about out of time again, and I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here, and we'll take this up again next time, talking about the awesome universe. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order one, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.